Palestinian struggle to liberate their country stands as one of the most enduring and contentious resistance movements in modern history. At its heart lies the issue of occupation, with Israel's presence in Palestinian territories being a source of deep-seated grievances, violence, and international concern. The roots of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories can be traced back to the late 19th and early 20th centuries, with the rise of the Zionist movements advocating for the establishment of a so-called Jewish homeland in historical Palestine. The Balfour Declaration of 1917, issued by the British government, lent support to these aspirations, laying the groundwork for the eventual creation of Israel in 1948. The events surrounding the creation of Israel in 1948, known as the Nakba, or the Catastrophe, marked a pivotal moment in the history of the region. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were displaced from their homes and became refugees as a result of the conflict between Israeli and Arab forces. In 1967, Israel launched a strike against Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, in what became known as the Six-Day War. Supported by its Western allies, including the United States and Britain, the Israeli regime occupied the West Bank, including East El-Quds, the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, and the Golan Heights. This marked the beginning of Israel's military occupation of Palestinian territories, which continues to this day. Palestinians tried all diplomatic and legal ways to end the Israeli occupation over the past seven decades. In the early 1990s, efforts were made to negotiate a peaceful resolution to allow Palestinians to have their own state. Known as the Oslo Accord, it never put an end to the Israeli aggression, as the regime continued settlement expansion in the occupied territories. There were other deals, including Camp David, which never resulted in peace and only emboldened Israel in its atrocities against Palestinians. Throughout its occupation of Palestinian territories, Israel has committed all kinds of atrocities against Palestinians, including massacres and non-stop human rights abuses, such as land confiscation, home demolitions, arbitrary arrests, and excessive use of force against Palestinian civilians. The Palestinian resistance to the Israeli occupation has taken various forms. It started from peaceful protests to civil disobedience. But with major world powers' unconditional support for Israel, under whose influence even Arab countries started normalizing ties with the regime, Palestinians found no alternative to armed resistance to achieve their rights. Palestinians decided to take up arms and fight for the liberation of their territory, with groups such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad gaining prominence in the popular struggle.
What do you think? Do you advise me to continue as a slave? It's a right which has been granted for us who are living under occupation. That the time the diplomacy and politics fail, it's a right of those people who are living under occupation to defend themselves with all means. The victory has to be snatched, especially when you are facing such extremist, murderous, criminal leadership of your enemy.
On October 7, 2023, the Palestinian resistance fighters launched their biggest operation yet, a massive and deadly response to over 70 years of Israeli atrocities against them. Thousands of rockets fired from Gaza rained down on the occupied territories. The projectiles reached as far north as Tel Aviv and as far east as El-Quds. Shortly after, Palestinian fighters stormed towns in the south, launching deadly attacks and taking more than 200 captives, including military personnel. The 10-hour Al-Aqsa flood operation dealt a humiliating blow to Israel's much-touted military and intelligence system. Shortly after the operation, the Israeli military launched a massive strike on the besieged Gaza Strip that has killed more than 30,000 people, most of them women and children, so far. The Israeli regime, encouraged by the U.S. and Western allies' support, outlined three major objectives for this onslaught on Gaza.
I have three goals. One goal is to defeat Hamas, utterly defeat and destroy Hamas. The second is to bring back our hostages. And the third is to ensure that we don't have a similar threat in the future from Gaza, and that what happens in Gaza is good for Israel, good for Palestinians, good for the Middle East. And to do that, we need to demilitarize Gaza and de-radicalize Gaza. We cannot have it mean for the foreseeable future Israeli overriding military responsibility.
The Israeli regime has not only failed to achieve the goals, but also was forced to negotiate with Hamas on a ceasefire. The failure to achieve these goals has not only exposed the limitations of Israel's military prowess, but has also highlighted the resilience and the determination of Palestinian resistance forces.
There is no doubt that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood represented a success for the resistance movement, a success in carrying out a large-scale operation without the enemy being able to take action preemptively. This operation succeeded in seizing the entire Gaza positions within just hours. This is undoubtedly a great achievement, but here's the question. Was there any expectation for the enemy's reaction? Certainly. It was expected that there would be a reaction, but it is the nature of the occupation. It kills you, seizes your land, arrests you, and imprisons you. For example, in the West Bank in 2022, before the operations, the number of martyrs was about 500. The number of wounded people who were taken to hospitals exceeded 3,000. We are talking about thousands of prisoners. Under this occupation for 75 years, you have two choices. Either you do nothing and it continues to kill you, capture you, and seize your land, or you resist and the enemy will continue the aggression. But the message will be conveyed that the Palestinian people are still adhering to their right to resist, that the enemy is paying a price for the occupation.
Operation Al-Aqsa Flood marked a significant turning point for the Palestinian people, showcasing the harsh reality of Israeli occupation to the world. This operation not only highlighted the plight of Palestinians, but also indicated the power of Palestinian resistance in a coastal territory which has been under siege for some 17 years. Prior to this operation, Arab states were moving towards normalizing ties with Israel, overshadowing the Palestinian cause. However, the Gaza war that ensued the October 7th operation has shifted global attention back to the long-standing struggle of Palestinians for freedom over the past seven decades. It's been a stark reminder of the brutality of the Israeli occupation. Despite Israel's military might and reputation, the war in Gaza has been perceived as a humiliating defeat for Israel on multiple fronts. Public opinion worldwide has increasingly turned against Israel as images of civilian casualties and destruction in Gaza have circulated widely, shedding light on the brutality by Israeli forces which left no safe zone in Gaza, hitting even hospitals and UN refugee shelters. The October 7th operation stands as a testament to the power of Palestinian resistance, showcasing how a small and determined movement can withstand the might of the Israeli army, backed by the US and other Western countries. This operation highlighted the unwavering resilience of the Palestinian people and emphasized that resistance is not only a means of survival, but also a powerful tool in securing their right to self-determination. The ability of Palestinian fighters to hold their ground against one of the most advanced armies in the world has not only defied expectations, but also exposed the limitations of military might in the face of steadfast resistance. The refusal to surrender in the face of overwhelming odds sends a powerful message that the Palestinian people will not be silenced or oppressed, but will continue to fight for their rights and their dignity.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord.
This word Quran.
Muhammad, praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters, and everyone out there listening. This is Youth Station with IRIB English Radio, and this is your host Mustafa, and with me in the studio is...
Yeah, I am Bita, the co-host of my brother, and it's a pleasure to be here again at Youth Station.
Definitely, it's always good to hear. It's always nice to be able to talk to youth, I think. You know,
yeah,
it's something
yeah,
I enjoy doing.
I believe so.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So the topic I want to discuss today with you is related to prejudice, right?
Yeah, nice topic.
It's definitely, I think, a topic that's relevant in our society, right? We see many different forms of prejudices. For example, we might see religion prejudice in religion from a race point of view, from, you know, your nationality. It could even be something as, you know, we may have prejudice against our families. Sometimes it may be prejudice against our family members, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think? Do you think there's any positives to it? Is it completely negative? You know, what can we do about these kind of prejudice that exist among us?
Yeah, it is a really difficult question that is it completely wrong or right to have prejudice? Mm. Because prejudice is a kind of blindly acceptance towards something. Mm. Not only you want to accept it blindly, but also you want other people and you want them to actually believe whatever beliefs that you have. And the thing that you mentioned, we have different categories of prejudice, like prejudice over your family, your nation, your country, your race, and about your beliefs. At the end of the day, it comes to the internal prejudice that is about your beliefs and so on. I believe that the goal of every human being is this self-awareness that we have to develop in ourselves. And this self-awareness comes out from knowledge. And right. When you have knowledge, prejudice, I believe, is meaningless in your world.
Definitely. You're right. I think a big part, a big source of prejudice among people is, you know, just lack of knowledge or understanding.
Exactly.
And, you know, I came across there's a few verses in the Quran which speak about prejudice, you know, the way it exists. Like, and God says that, you know, He's created us in different, with different tongues and different colors. In one place He says, so that we get to know each other.
Yeah.
Right? So He presents these differences as a positive means for us to get to know each other. In another place He says that, you know, it's a sign for you. It's one of my signs for you that you recognize me because I created you in so many different ways.
Yeah.
So, we can take these things both positively and negatively, right?
Actually, you mentioned a beautiful verse of Holy Quran that we created you both from women and men, and the only difference that you have is about your piety and your virtue.
So we just have to go for a quick break, and then we'll come back for
the
rest of the discussion.
Oh,
we've been discussing the topic of prejudice, you know, among religion, among race, in our families. Were you saying something right before we were going to the break?
Yeah, I wanted to mention a new dimension towards this prejudice that we're talking about. Actually, there is a specific thing in our culture or in our country mostly, but it's about all culture, you know. And this is the word qirah or qirah.
Actually, it's not only cultural. It's something that exists in our religion as well.
Yeah. It's a common religious belief among all of the Muslim ummah that there is something, a definition that we call it qirat. There is no kind of equal word for this in English culture, but it's a combination of the bravery that you put on saving and supporting your pride about your family, about your religion, and actually it's a good dimension of prejudice, we can call it. And what do you think about it?
Right. It's definitely an interesting question. I don't know how much I would include it as part of prejudice, maybe, but it is. You can sort of see it that way. The whole problem with the word is that, like you said, there's no equivalent of it in English. But the idea is that you protect your honor, right? You protect your family's honor. You protect your, like, nation's honor. And yes, from that point of view, it is something positive. But the idea is that you don't think that you're better than others. You're trying to protect something which is good, right, from oppression.
Exactly.
So if there's oppression out there, then in that place, this type of prejudice can be very beneficial, I think.
Right? Yeah, I do agree with that one, that there is so much good in this beautiful way of protecting your family, your ideas, and your beliefs. But it's good at this level, at this time, and at this boundary. When you cross these boundaries, and when your protection will have the tinge of prejudice, it will become something annoying and disgusting for other people.
The problem is that when the negativity comes in when it turns into arrogance, right?
Yeah.
In fact, I was just speaking to, you know, the driver that brought me here, and we were just saying that, you know, basically Shaitan, Iblis, right? That's what he did. He took like one attribute of himself, that he was made of fire.
Exactly.
And he took that as a, you know, being better than others. When we start thinking that we're better than others because of our race or religion, that's when it becomes an issue, right?
Yeah.
That's so what would you say is a way to sort of remove that arrogance from people?
You know what, as you mentioned, the underlying root of this behavior of prejudice is this arrogance that we have over other people, that we think we're better, we think we're this and that. And again, there is a reason for this behavior of arrogance, which is the criteria and the standards that we are identifying for evaluating people. Okay, when you have difficult criteria for evaluating people, then it will lead to the road of prejudice. When you think, for example, being from the, I'm just giving you an example about the racism. When you are actually standardizing the colors of people as a value, then it will lead to ignorance.
Right.
I mean, so the first step to change this behavior is to change your basic beliefs about values.
Right.
And this is the point.
Okay.
And when you change your values, then your ignorance will be diminished, will be faded away. And the problem will be solved, I believe.
All right, so thank you so much. We'll have to go for a break, and we'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Okay, so we're back for the break, and you know, one of the things that I've lived in different countries, you know, and I've definitely faced prejudice and racism. One of the ways that I think that you can sort of get rid of prejudice in people is just spending time with them. So, give you an example. When I was young, I was about 15, 16 years old. There was this is back in a Western country.
Yeah.
And one of the guys in my class, you know, he was very racist. You know, he would call me like Pocky, and he would,
he'd
say you're brown, and he would just push me around many times. And he ended up getting into a fight with me once, right? So he got beat up pretty badly by me, and then after that fight, okay, he became friends with me.
Yeah.
Okay, he started spending time with me.
Nice.
And then he realized that, you know, that I'm not very different from him or from others, right? I'm just another person.
Exactly.
And we became really good friends after that. So a lot of times you just need to be able to spend time with people, and you, and that's it. That will solve the solution many times.
So you mentioned a really important fact that sometimes the reason of this prejudice is lack of knowledge. When you don't know someone, when you see a stranger, your defensive mechanism is to put your guards high and feel like that person is your enemy and you have to fight with that person. But when you get close to the other people, other races, other religions, and other beliefs, you will understand that they are human beings too. They
right.
have some common beliefs as you. They have some kindness and humanity. For example, when I was younger, I thought, like, for example, foreigners were some strangers and aliens or something like that, that they have so many different cultural gap with us. But no, cultural gap is not something that much to make you feel you're different from other human beings. At the end of the day, we're all humans.
Right. And, you know, part of that, a big part of that, you know, understanding that we're humans is going back to your point one about, you know, gaining knowledge.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think today's world, we're living in a very globalized world, right? Like everyone's connected to everyone else. Most countries that you go to, there are people from different countries living there. So if somebody's still holding on to like sort of prejudiced beliefs, then, you know, they're doing themselves harm, right?
Yeah.
That's one of the other things that we don't realize is that by being prejudiced against others, if you're thinking about it, we're actually really causing ourselves harm.
Yeah.
You know, the other person isn't really losing anything. It's we're the ones that are losing something. We're not learning about others. We're not gaining from them, right?
Yeah.
So I think we need to be much more broad-minded and open-minded when we speak to others about others' beliefs, even if it's a non-Muslim, I feel. You know,
definitely.
We shouldn't have that kind of negative view towards others.
And I believe we have to consider another dimension of this topic, which is it doesn't mean that you have to accept the other people's beliefs, and
right.
or it doesn't mean that you have to be that open to change your own true beliefs into some deviated forms of that. It means that you have to protect your beliefs, and if there is opportunity for you, you can invite other people to the truth and the true path, and at the same time we can be friends with them. There is no arrogance, there is no ignorance.
You know what happens in like back in Pakistan sometimes is that people get into very heated debates, right?
Yeah,
because and it could be even like Shia among Shia or Muslims among Muslims,
yeah.
who have like different ideas. They get like emotional, they like stop talking to each other sometimes.
Yeah,
you know, they become enemies of each other. Whereas what we see in our religion, or what I would say is the more common sense view, is that you can just sit down and have discussions with people.
Exactly.
Okay, you don't have to like convince others that you're right. You just need to share information with them. And based off of that, if your information is good, they'll automatically accept like, what you have to say. So we have to be, when I say we have to be open-minded, you're right. We don't have to accept the other person's like views, but we need to be respectful of their views, you know, so they can return that respect to us as well.
So the key word here, I believe, is respect. We have to respect in a mutual way. And also, we have to focus on our knowledge and on our reasoning in order to convince other people beautifully in what we think is right. And the other part is sometimes we have to give this chance to other people to exchange their beliefs, to exchange their ideas. Maybe we are the one who's wrong. Who knows?
Exactly. And I have been in many situations where I've realized that I was wrong, you know? So that's definitely something we all have to work on, by the
way.
You know, we all have a little bit of prejudice in us, I think.
Exactly.
And we all have to work on making ourselves better. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and please join us again.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings, be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Allah, 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 Allah.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we will be exploring the Islamic upbringing of children and youth, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed some light on this important subject. Salaamu Alaikum, Sister Salma, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Alaikum Salaam wa Rahmatullahi wa Barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
So we had been discussing about the question in the previous episode, which was, this lady saying that her 15-year-old daughter doesn't connect with her, doesn't talk with her, and she doesn't know what she's going through, and that the daughter feels that she's nagging very much. So how to make this relationship better in order for the daughter to confide in her? And you said that, you know, sometimes they become aloof because they want their independence, or because maybe the parents are not active listeners, or the mother has to try and make the girl feel more reassured and that she should feel that empathy when, you know, confiding with her mother.
And also that calmness of the behavior should be felt so that they can come out with what problem they have.
Yeah.
Now, as when they start talking, then there should be no judgments passed. For example, but I think this way, or this is the case. Mm-hmm. No. Or there should be no advice given.
Straight away?
Yeah. No advice given, or there should be no arguments done. Why did you do that? No. It should be just listening.
Okay.
Listening with an open mind. And then, you know, when they listen with empathy and share, and probably something that maybe it's very difficult for them to, feel very bad about on account of that, then the parents should even agree to that. Say that it must be very hard for you.
Yeah.
I can imagine what you must be going through. So this understanding, this empathy is very important for them. That's the first step.
Okay.
So they may then tell, then they may see, then they may ask for guidance also and ask them, what do you think should be done? Once you get that, what do you think should be done? Then you can offer your very, very, you know, like polite and loving guidance. That you don't want them to go astray. If they don't ask, then you can tell them at the end, after posing a lot,
yeah.
Then don't you think that if, for example, you would do this or you would go about this way, this is being very careful, you see.
It's like you're trying to make them reach the conclusion by themselves, just by you guiding them slowly.
As you, they should take the conclusion themselves. Yeah. That's a very important point you said, that then they'll really enjoy doing that.
They feel they made the decision.
They made the decision, exactly. There are so many problems that they might be facing in school, for example. You know, maybe their grades are not proper. Maybe their friends tease them a lot or something like that. Then they are just like, you know, perplexed of how to go about it, what to do, what do they answer back, or do they keep quiet? Things like that can be discussed at length with the parent, whatever she deems that is right according to the Islamic way and the human way. Okay? Then they can be guided right. And of course, then, you know, make them so like feel confident and get so much reassurance and love from the family that they don't even need it from outside.
Very true.
You know? They feel so full of that love that they can now give that love.
Definitely.
They don't need to receive it and be reassured.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that they are hungry for that love. You should give them that ounce, those ounces of love that they feel that they can tackle with any kind of problem because they have a strong hold with them.
Yeah, there's something to lean on.
Yeah.
Definitely. So we're just going to take a quick break and we'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. So welcome back to Arab English Radio, and we have been discussing about one of the questions about how the lady wanted to connect with her daughter. And one of the very important things you said was the calmness in the behavior that you have with the child. And when the child starts to open up, you know, you don't have to be judgmental or give advices straight away or start arguments. Rather, just try and listen and they will slowly, you know, open up. And it's kind of you're going to let them reach the conclusion on their own.
That's right.
Yeah.
Another way to actually enhance this conversation and talking with the daughter, who is like remains aloof. In fact, this is a bit rare because many daughters want to speak a lot to their parents. Only sometimes, really, you know, the parents don't have time for the children, or they don't show proper empathy, or they feel that it, you know, this is secondhand for them. Like they're always there, they take it for granted. The children, the parents take it for granted. They don't consciously do things for the children to make them feel that now, okay, they're going through a phase. They need more. You see,
yeah,
like a child who is reaching the teenage age has so many changes going on, body, hormonal changes, thought changes, feelings, emotions, all these things change rapidly. So at this time they themselves don't understand certain things and they become frustrated. So they want so much support, and the parents, they just see that this is an everyday thing. My child is growing up in front of me.
Yeah.
They don't realize that there's a big shift from childhood to now teenage years. Between adulthood and a child is the teenage, you see?
Yeah.
Between an adult and a child is the teenage phase. So they don't realize this, so they take it for granted. So it happens so that things keep on going and building up, and then becomes a relationship that is so like, you know, icy cold. When they grow up, they get married, they remain aloof, and life goes on like that, instead of that warmth to be there always, and that love and that caring and the dua exchanging of each other. Even the child doesn't feel like praying so much for the mother or being with the mother, remembering the mother or the parents, for instance. The father, even the mother can cover up for the father. That much she's strong, you know. Like if the father is not around, the mother can cover up and compensate and even talk good of the father that he doesn't have time, but he loves you so much. So the child will always feel that, yeah, I have a reassurance there that my parents love me. Because so at some point in time, the father will show the love. Of course, he didn't have time so much to be together with the children. But then he will feel like wanting, and he will want to be reciprocated also.
Definitely.
And when he'll get a, I see reciprocation, he'll feel bad about it. So the mother is the one to do all this. Now here, very important point is for her to be positive.
Yeah.
Positive attitude is very important in every kind of way, that it opens up the areas of conversation. For example, if I'm negative in everything, oh, today it was so cold, oh, I'm so sick, okay, oh, I can't bear it now, I have to sleep, I'm tired, oh, I can't cook, you people do it yourself, or things like that, or the floor is so dirty, it's so messy, or your room is always dirty, and tidy your room.
Negative energy.
Negative, oh, this person did this, or, oh, look at this, it's so late, oh, you've come so late, all these negative things pile up for a negative behavior and for that anxiety to be filled in the air, the atmosphere. So you should be like always positive, mm-hmm. always. Oh, like for example, if the daughter looks good, today you look very nice. Or suddenly, oh, you look too happy now, alhamdulillah. Or you prayed very nicely. Or for example, you look very clean.
Mm-hmm.
Or your bath has made you fresh. Or for example, this so-and-so person did this to me. Or what a nice handbag that person had, yeah. Everything should be in the positive way. So ultimately, the child learns positivity rather than negativity. And no complaints.
Very true.
So positivity is too important in every way. In fact, our religion teaches a lot about positivity. We can talk that later on.
Yeah, inshallah. Thank you. We're just going to take a short break and we'll be back soon.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we have been discussing about how to create this bond between a mother and child so that they're able to confide. And the last thing you mentioned, Sister Salma, was that they're going through so many changes in their life, they need that support, and so the parents have to try and keep like a positive environment, you know, keep positive comments, because that's going to really affect their the child's like happiness and moods, and yeah, definitely.
So even in our religion of Islam, we are told to be so positive. For example, if you've sinned, Allah says, I'll still accept it, as long as you're not doing it purposely. Purposely means to anger Allah. I'm doing something to anger Allah. I think 99% of the humans don't have this in their intention, that I want to anger Allah, that's why I'm doing this. So how to be hopeful of Allah's mercy? When there's a hadith that says that however my servant thinks of me, I am that way for him. So if I think that he's loving me, attending to me, and forgiving my mistakes, and knowing my weaknesses, maybe if I commit some mistakes or sins, so he knows this is my weakness, so he'll still give me other chances. Though I always, when I do tawbah, I have to tell myself, no, I won't return back to that sin. But Allah is too compassionate. So you know, all these things are so positive. Yeah. Deen Islam is so positive. So Allah is teaching us that, you know, be positive in your character, so your attitude at home with all those around you, you know, give that air of positivity to your children so that they even can learn that and become successful and not, you know, become disheartened or anxious about little things. They will know a way, a window to get out of that situation.
Definitely. And I think that's, like you said, that's what Islam is all about. And that's why one of the bigger, greater sins, very important ones was, doing yes, you know, losing hope in Allah. Allah wants us to constantly have hope in Him, you know, that we can always turn back to Him no matter what situation we're in. So I think that's very, very important for youth to know, because that is why, you know, suicide rates are going high, or, you know, other like getting into addictions. When you have this kind of pure source to turn to all the time, you kind of realize that nothing else is more important, and you will turn to Him.
Yeah.
And like you said, all of these things are what's going to cultivate and make you go towards that pure Lord,
who,
you know, kind of forget that these other things are not as important.
Exactly. So positivity should be inculcated in a teenager who wants to have an open conversation, like to the parent wants you know, to have an open conversation, a good conversation, a friendly conversation, a loving, empathetic conversation. So they should be positive, to give that feeling out of positivity, so that the child knows that even if I talk to my parents, they'll be positive about me. They won't be, say, you know, like looking at my negative aspects. They won't complain and say, they will look at the good half side of the beauty of it.
Yeah.
So inshallah, we also look at it and look at all the teachings of our religion and go towards this, so that we can bring our children to become our good companions and
definitely
our friends. Yeah.
And I think it's actually not so difficult to open up with your teenagers. I remember when I used to teach, sometimes some teenagers, they would be very aloof, but it's not so difficult to, you know, kind of tap into their feelings. You just have to show your compassionate side. You have to show that you'll give them time. You're not going to judge them. All of these things make them feel that they can confide in you.
Yeah.
So, inshallah, that all parents become such that
yeah.
all their children.
The thing is, only the parents sometimes close their minds to the fact that they were young one day. So if we open our minds one day that we were young and how we were feeling, then and get to their minds, then we would be able to have a very good rapport.
Definitely.
Very good, you know, like relationship.
Inshallah. So thank you so much for joining us today. The discussion was very fruitful. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. And this was IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. If you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI, which is Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can also email us on englishradio@irib.ir. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Muslims across the world have spent the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan marking Al-Quds Day. The day was designated by Imam al-Khomeini, who commanded Muslims to institute this day in order to always keep the cause of Palestine fresh in the hearts and minds of Muslims everywhere. This episode will discuss Al-Quds Day, in particular in the context of the extra importance it takes with regards to the current genocidal war Israel is waging on the people of Palestine. First, we take a look at the ideology of Imam Khomeini with regards to Palestine and what drove him to institute Al-Quds Day.
The Zionist occupation of Palestine was preceded by the injection of the poison of nationalism, a concept totally alien to the Quranic concept of the Ummah, the single faith community. The ideology of Arab nationalism fragmented the Muslim masses when they were confronted by Zionist nationalism in a conflict over control of Palestine, as they could only be mobilized on the basis of Islam, not on the basis of an alien ideology imported from the West. The Western powers pursued a long-term strategy, first defeating the Ottoman Empire and then planting their agents in the fragmented body of the Ummah in the Global South. Muslims ended up with traitorous rulers who were nurtured by the colonialist powers and are therefore loyal to them. David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, candidly admitted that the Arab regimes are Israel's first line of defense. These regimes have continued to suppress the Islamic movement. It was in this grim situation that the Islamic Revolution succeeded in Iran in 1979. Soon thereafter, Imam Khomeini, as the first truly Islamic leader to emerge in the Ummah in the post-colonial period, took a number of decisions that had far-reaching implications. The Islamic State severed all links with the Zionist state and expelled its agents from Iran. The Imam then proclaimed that only the mobilization of Muslim masses would liberate the first Qibla of Islam from the clutches of Zionism. Towards this end, he declared that the last Friday of Ramadan should be marked as Yawm al-Quds, the Day of Al-Quds, on which Muslims throughout the world should reaffirm their determination and commitment to end the continued occupation of Al-Quds and Palestine by the Zionist invaders. Imam Khomeini located the struggle of the Muslim masses in the very roots of Islam, in the month of Ramadan, where Muslims worldwide not only fast together, but also congregate over the recitation of the Word of God and the remembrance of significant Islamic history and victories like that of Badr. By observing the Day of Al-Quds, Muslims not only begin to fulfill a political obligation, they also acknowledge a religious one. The protection of Islam's sacred places is a duty that is incumbent upon all Muslims. As long as Al-Quds remains in the clutches of Zionism, this duty remains unfulfilled, and mobilizing the Muslim Ummah toward this objective becomes a religious obligation.
Now, to discuss this important topic are two very special guests. We're honored to welcome Masood Shajara. Brother Masood is the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, which organizes legal support for Muslims targeted by the state. The IHRC has been one of the organizers of the annual Quds Day in London for several decades. I'm also honored to welcome back Sister Noor Fekri to the show. Sister Noor is a politics graduate with a keen interest in West Asian affairs. She uses her social media platform to analyze religious and political events in a way that is accessible to the everyday person. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you for joining us here to discuss what is a really momentous day in the Islamic world and wider, actually. Sister Noor, if I could begin with you. Firstly, we just heard there some of the context behind why Imam Khomeini did establish Quds Day, and I wanted to ask you, like, why did he make such efforts? What was he worried about in terms of perhaps Muslims forgetting the importance of Palestine during that era?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I honestly don't think he thought people would forget Palestine. If you look around today and ask people about Palestine, absolutely everyone is aware of what is going on in Palestine. So I think the Imam actually had an incredible ability of basira, being able to see into the future and foresee that actually people will remember. Al-Quds Day then, we could say 40 years ago, could have been established in order to remind people then, because then the Palestine folder had been put onto the shelves, gathering dust. There were peace agreements that were being made, failed Oslo Accords, constant failed agreements, as though you can agree with the colonizer, as though you can negotiate with the colonizer. And people were starting to forget the Palestinian issue. But he brought it back onto the list of priorities. He made it a top priority. He removed the Israeli occupation entity embassy from Tehran and erected a Palestinian embassy. He recognized Palestine as a state, which is significant, as one state recognizing another. And so back then, he made people remember it through Al-Quds Day. However, today, he made it a reoccurring event. So it's something that happens every single Ramadan, which is, by the way, Islam's holiest month, and on a Friday, which is Islam's holiest day, to unite people in the future. It wasn't necessarily to remind them. And through this unity, he attempted to unite Muslims to counter the sectarianism that the West tried to sort of get people to occupy themselves with. So, for instance, they would occupy people's minds by telling them that Palestinians are Sunnis, and why should Shia Lebanese or Shia Iranians or Zaydi Yemenis defend Palestine? So he, with Al-Quds Day, destroyed the idea of sectarianism and united people through the banner of Palestine in Islam.
Absolutely. And Brother Masood, as the sister rightly mentioned there, you know, there have been attempts to, which persist to this day, to stress and focus on sectarian differences maybe that appear. But, the status of Al-Quds is quite central in Islam itself. What is it about Al-Quds exactly that makes it so important to the religion of Islam and to Muslims around the world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The obvious is that it was the first Qibla of Muslims and is one of the holiest sites in Islam. And but I think it goes far beyond that. I mean, what the sister said is absolutely right about the importance of Al-Quds and why it was instigated. I'm old enough to remember it at the time. At that time, the struggle for freedom of Palestine was being shifted between the East and the West. You know, people were going towards Americans and for trying to get Palestinians free, or another group of people, or a few years later they were going towards communism as a solution. And Imam Khomeini at that time, when there was no single international day of remembrance of plight of the Palestinians, established Al-Quds Day as an Islamic solution to the problems of region. And I think that was really significant, because it sort of clarified, and it's even the significance of it right now is the same, that yes, it is this holy place, yes, it's very important, but what is the solution? The solution is resistance. The solution is actually removal of Zionism and oppression as an ideology, and the solution needs to be defined by the people who are living there. And I think this is what makes Al-Quds Day even very important now, because what we are saying very clearly, that people in Palestine, the oppressed people, people who are facing the greatest genocide of our time, have got the right and indeed the duty to resist against it under international law, under any moral values or basis. And that is the solution. And the solution at end of it is remove, not just, just make Israel a smaller place or larger place. Mm. Actually, like South Africa, the apartheid needs to be removed. Mm. Apartheid cannot be reformed. And that is the basis of this. And I think it's very important that this voice is heard every year at the month of Ramadan, because it's an Islamic solution that actually gives platform to not just Muslims fighting others. It's actually giving empowerment to Muslims, Christians and others to become the masters of their future in occupied Palestine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the Ramadan element is so important, and it highlights the basira of Imam al-Khomeini, because it's when Muslims are most engaged and focused on the communal aspect and maybe have a higher sense of spiritualism.
I mean, but if you actually think that the whole month we fast to become a better human being.
Yeah, exactly.
And if we look at this this sort of state, which is not just endangering Palestinians, but endangering humanity.
Yeah.
I mean, for God's sake, this is not just about saving Palestinians. If we go down this route of legitimizing these genocide, the whole of the humanity is at danger. And I think if the whole month of Ramadan, we don't think about this, we don't find a solution to this, we don't become part of that solution, then what's the point of fasting the whole
month? Sister Noor, how does Al-Quds Day take extra significance this year in particular?
I think it takes extra significance for obvious reasons. I mean, there's a literal genocide taking place, even thinking about what they're doing to the Palestinian people. I mean, I can't stop trembling thinking about them bombing buildings and killing babies. And it's just incredibly disgusting. It is out of this world disgusting what they're doing to the Palestinian people. So I think naturally this year is going to be extra significant for us, because we're going to be with Palestine in our hearts, minds and prayers. But when we're talking about sort of the significance of Al-Quds Day in general, I think Brother Masoud really touched on the idea of resistance. It is the slogan, Al-Quds is the slogan of the resistance movement. If you think about Iran, for example, they have a branch of their military called Al-Quds Force. The Lebanese, they call themselves martyrs for Al-Quds. The Yemenis, you know, they've been bombing US ships in the sea all for Al-Quds. So it really unites people. But I think when we're talking about the significance this year, the main important point that I've really realized is this shift in narrative from people. And we were seeing influencers like Subhi, I'm sure you've seen him on Instagram, who has hundreds of thousands of followers. And his post went viral where he said, you know what, I support the resistance. Enough is enough of us sort of setting empty Free Palestine chants with nothing to back it up. And I think that's really what Al-Quds Day stands for. Mm-hmm. It's that sort of people that really support resistance. And that's what's becoming prominent. People want to join that caravan of truth this year. And they don't want to be left behind.
Absolutely. And it's probably for that reason why Al-Quds Day is targeted the way it is. In that context, we could take a look at some of the Al-Quds Days of years gone by and look at the incidents of violence and oppression that have been meted out against those believers who attend these events.
Ever since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, The last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan has been designated as Quds Day, as per the orders of the late Imam Khomeini. But the day has seen a number of major incidents take place, as it has become a target for tyrants, Zionists and terrorists the world over. In 1985, during the Iran-Iraq War, Iranians were commemorating Quds Day in Iran when bombers and long-range missiles sent by Saddam's regime struck 14 Iranian cities, killing at least 78 people. In 2010, in Quetta, Pakistan, a suicide bomber attacked Pakistani Shias holding a Quds Day rally. The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack, which killed at least 65 people and wounded 160. In 2012, as the Persian Gulf Kingdom of Bahrain was roiled by ongoing anti-government protests, that year's Quds Day was also met with deadly force by British-trained security forces, and one man was killed. Then in 2014 came one of the most pivotal events in the history of Al-Quds Day. In Zaria, Nigeria, where the leader of the Islamic movement, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, is based, the Nigerian army opened fire on the Quds Day rally and killed 35 people, including three of Sheikh Zakzaki's sons. This was followed by another massacre the following year that killed over 1,000 followers of the Islamic movement, including another three of the Sheikh's sons, and led to the kidnapping of him and his wife and hundreds of other followers by the Nigerian regime. Despite the targeting of those who attend the annual Quds Day march across the world, the continued presence of millions of people shows both the foresight of Imam Khomeini and the enduring nature of the cause of Al-Quds in the hearts.
Now, Brother Masoud, we heard about some examples there. Can you expand on a few of those examples of Muslims and others being, you know, attacked and killed on this specific day?
Yes, I think the fact of the matter is that it's been targeted, by the Zionists, targeted by those who actually want to undermine the empowerment of Muslims to rise up against this one of the institutions of Zionism, which is actually killing and committing all these crimes. Zaria sort of attack was horrible. I went to Zaria just after that attack and investigated. It was said that three of the sheikh's children were killed in that attack. One was killed in that attack. Two of them were picked up and assassinated in an army base afterward, and many others who died out of 28 were killed deliberately, assassinated. You know, we don't have to go far. Osborne, who attacked an individual outside Finsbury Park Mosque, he came to London targeting Al-Quds Day, and he actually failed to reach the Al-Quds demonstration on time, and that's why he changed his plan and targeted the Finsbury Park Mosque. Yeah. In court hearing, the judge said, "You, a horrible man, came to London to target a demonstration of innocent people, family and children, a peaceful demonstration." So really it's been seen that this demonstration is a demonstration of ordinary people standing up for what is just, what is fair, and what is necessary, because to stop this genocide taking place must be the duty of every one of us. And at the same time, we are seeing that those who are coming to London and elsewhere, they're coming from the Muslim, Christian, Jewish, and indeed secular background. Those who are targeting it is also axis of evil. There are Zionists, there are sort of Iranian pro-Shah claiming to be democratic and so forth and so on. So there is what we see very clearly.
And so you mentioned Jewish as well, and that community that come to Al-Quds Day and support Palestine and the Torah Charter, they are a small but vocal group of Jewish clerics, if you will, who support